Hello, and welcome to How Things Grow. How Things Grow is a podcast about growth and the people who drive it. Join me, your host Shamant Rao, as I speak with some of the smartest people in tech and go behind the scenes of growth trajectories of companies and technologies that power our world today. We dive into the stories of many of these growth leaders and their companies. We talk about origins, early victories, strokes of luck, troughs of failure, and much more, and deconstruct many of the things that they do to drive dramatic growth for their companies and technologies. How Things Grow is presented by me, Shamant Rao, and supported today by Catherine Funk, our audio producer. I'm the founder and CEO of the growth consulting firm Rocketship HQ. I've been fortunate enough to have driven growth leading up to three exits. I've also been the travel editor of Mint Lounge, formerly the partner newspaper of the Wall Street Journal in India. This is a special episode. We take a very short break from our regular programming of interviews of growth practitioners because I've been in the middle of a personal transition. We will be back with interviews of growth practitioners in a week and a half. However, in this episode, I present to you my talk at my alma mater, the Indian Institute of Technology, Madras, last year. This is a talk called The Unseen Forces Driving Mass Adoption of Technologies, featuring 8 key takeaways from season 1 of How Things Grow. I spoke to some of the smartest engineering students in India because the Indian Institutes of Technology, the IITs, tend to be super selective with an acceptance rate of under 1%. Fun fact, in one of my favorite Dilbert strips, Ashok says, "Luckily, I'm an IIT graduate, superior to most people on earth, so I finished the project myself." Dilbert asks him, "Are you tired?" Ashok gets back, "I'm trained to sleep only during national holidays." Those were the kind of kids that I spoke to. Anyway, while some of the effect of the talk itself is lost because the actual talk was accompanied by a slide deck, I think you'll still find some of the takeaways and highlights from season one that are the core of this particular talk very, very interesting. Without further ado, here you go on my talk, The Unseen Forces That Drive Mass Adoption of Technologies, 8 Learnings from Season 1 of How Things Grow. Okay. Great, you guys. I'm going to talk about the unseen forces that drive mass adoption of technologies. And this is because I think as engineers, we all think about making technologies, building technologies. And I think it's worth asking ourselves, what makes technologies go mainstream, right? What drives consumer adoption? What separates really smart ideas from ideas that actually change the world? Here's a little bit about me. This was me back in IITM. I promise it's the same person as me. I founded the IITM Open Quiz many, many years ago. I don't know if it's still active. At least a couple of years ago, it was around. Edited the Fourth Estate, which I believe is a predecessor of the Fifth Estate. Is that right? Okay, great. And of course, that's University Challenge on BBC World. That's me in the national semifinals, which we lost, but we made it to the semifinals. Great. And also about me, so right now I head up a growth consulting firm called Rocketship HQ. We help fast growing companies grow faster. And like Mishta said, I host the How Things Grow podcast. In the past, I helped grow 2 companies to exits. Also, fun thing I did was I worked as a travel editor for Mint, the newspaper, for just over 2 years. That's something I did for fun, nothing to do with what we're going to talk about today. So what we're going to talk about is going to be mainly informed by what I did in growth, how I worked on products that grew, right? To get us started, let's have a pop quiz. What's the biggest category of apps on the app stores? Anyone?
Games.
Games, spot on, right? That wasn't much of a challenge for this audience. Great, thank you, man. Yeah, so the reason I point that out is, that's, if you think about it, that's such a seismic change in the way we consume information. Just in the last 2 decades, right? We were watching TV as a species. We were watching a lot of TV. We shifted to laptops and we shifted to smartphones. And the kind of apps that take up most of our smartphone time and money are games. If you think about it, if you'd asked somebody 20 years ago, hey, we're going to have handheld devices, they might have said, oh, maybe that's kind of possible. But if you told them, you would be playing Hole.io, you'd be playing Hello Stars, Go Fish, Helix Jump, I don't think anybody would have believed it. I wouldn't have, right? And part of the perspective I'm hoping to bring is actually from having seen a lot of this change happen in the last 5 to 6 years, because I've worked with some of these games. I've actually seen how games basically took over the app stores, right? And hopefully from having seen one industry gain so much mass adoption, hopefully I'm able to share some perspectives on why technologies in general can have very unexpected behavior like this, how they can have very unexpected paths to adoption. And none of us see it coming, right? This is what people basically said about some of the technologies that have become mainstream, right? Uber, they said, this was, the first two were basically by investors who were offered the chance to put money into Uber and Airbnb. Uber, they're like, oh, well, I don't think it's going to go to anything outside small cities with big tech communities. Because they're like, who wants to order a car from your phone, right? Who wants to do it? Likewise, Airbnb, market opportunity did not seem large enough. Who wants to have strangers in their homes? The third one, I think there's a world market for maybe 5 computers. That was the CEO and founder of IBM, by the way, Thomas Watson, right? So we are spectacularly bad at predicting what technologies take off. We're spectacularly bad at understanding what's going to see mass adoption, right? And even when we think we know what technology is going to emerge, we actually, the form that it's going to take, we can be very off. So if you were to say, okay, handheld devices are going to take off. You founded a company in 1999, called it BlackBerry, right? And you would be right that handheld devices are the future, but you would be upstaged by a device that launched 8 years after you, right? Who here remembers what's on the bottom left-hand corner? Yay, some of you guys do, right? So what the hell happened, right? And I'm sure everyone knows what's on the top bottom right corner, right? So even if you had said social networking is going to be the next big thing, you all would have had Orkut accounts in 2004. None of us do now, right? So you called the future right in that, okay, social networking is going to be a thing, but the form that it actually took was very, very different from what we thought it would be, right? And this, why is all of this important? Why is it important to understand what technology will emerge, what technology will be a part of the future? Because you're the guys building the next wave of technologies, right? I have friends who work in Facebook and Uber and all these places. Again, this is perhaps a tongue-in-cheek quote. What we learn from history is that we don't learn from history. But I think the corollary is very true, which is that if you do learn from history, if you can identify some of these patterns, I think there's a lot to be gained, right? And as engineers who will build the next wave of technologies, understanding what drives this adoption could make the difference between starting the next Orkut or starting the next Facebook, right? It could make the difference between working on the next BlackBerry versus working on the next iPhone, right? And even though this is a bit of a tongue-in-cheek quote, there are patterns. There are specific things that are common to technologies that have widespread adoption. Right?
And you can identify some of these things because you can learn, A, you can learn from history, and B, you can talk to people who have done some of these things, as I have. I lived through how smartphones and games really took over, but I also had a chance to speak to some of the smartest people who worked in growth, who have grown products, and I had a chance to sit them down and ask questions as to what made the difference, why some of these technologies got adopted, and why some did not. Of course, a lot of this is on my podcast, How Things Grow. You can check it out, howthingsgrow.co. But my hope for this talk is to distill 8 forces that contribute to widespread adoption of technologies. 8 forces that can make a difference between widespread adoption or, you know, the fact that nobody's going to even use the technology, right? Or widespread adoption versus rapid decline. What makes a difference? What are some of the factors that can make, that can make this difference? So without further ado, let's look at 8 of these factors and let's try and understand what are some of these factors that drive widespread adoption. Number one, one of my favorite examples, one of my favorite stories, right? Force number one, enable partners to grow at scale. So we, like, you know, some of you pointed out, nobody uses Orkut now. One of the reasons that Facebook really, really ascended in the between 2005 and 2010 is that they enabled their partners to scale. They enabled their partners to grow. Since I like pop quizzes, what am I talking about when I say partners? Any guesses? If you use Facebook between 2005 and 2010, what would you have seen? Not a lot of advertisers. Advertisements happened after 2010.
Participatory users.
What does that mean?
Users that are using further than you expected or you at the moment doing with your product.
Sure, that's certainly a factor, but they weren't necessarily partners. They certainly made sure that users participated and engaged. Any other guesses? If you had gone on Facebook sometime between 2005 and 2010, you would probably have seen something like this, right? Does anyone at all remember this? Yeah, what's this? Yes, right? These are the farming games, right? And games were a huge category on Facebook. And what Facebook did, and were very, very smart about this, was they enabled games to grow. They also enabled other apps like Spotify to grow. And here's how they did it. They enabled games to grow by allowing every game developer to send out notifications like this. Right? They said, hey, if you're making a game, hey, we're going to make it really easy for you to make games on the Facebook platform. We are also going to make it super easy for you to invite other people to use this game. Right? We're going to make it super easy for you to send notifications to all your friends. So they come back, they use the game, and what happens as a result? More people are on Facebook, right? Because Facebook enabled its partners, the partners saw greater and greater usage. Even if you would think this is spam, you'd get an email in your inbox and that says, your best friend XYZ invited you because she's gifted you 2 new pigs to play in Farmville, right? We can laugh about it, but all of us got those emails. All of us who were on Facebook at the time got those invites. Many of us clicked and went back. And this was one of the biggest factors that contributed to the ascent of Facebook. Orkut, on the other hand, how many of you had cows on Orkut? The 3 of you, you had cows? You had an account, but you didn't have cows. Yeah. Yeah, you didn't buy milk on Orkut. Yeah, so you couldn't, right? Because Google said, we're going to maintain a pristine user experience. And Facebook said, we're going to enable our partners to grow. you know which one prevailed. And this has nothing to do with engineering firepower, because Google probably had way more engineers working on this than Facebook did, right? It's not engineering prowess. It's what strategy you pick, whether you choose a pristine user experience or whether you're letting your partners grow and scale, right? And that's basically a virtuous cycle that led to the emergence of Facebook. Another example that I like to give is the iTunes Store, right? Who are the partners for the iTunes Store? Every app, right? Games, but also every other app, right? Uber, Lyft, every other app and all the games. Because iTunes allowed these partners to host apps to make purchases. They basically opened up their platform, iTunes grew, and with that, the iPhone grew. The challenge with BlackBerry was that they don't have that robust developer ecosystem at all, right? So the takeaway for you guys is, if you have a platform, ask yourselves, how can you enable your partners to scale? How can you enable your partners to grow, right? And I think that can be a very powerful force that can drive mass adoption of technologies. Our second force is you balance supply and demand. You balance marketplaces to solve chicken and egg problems. So let's say you started a ride-sharing company in, let's say, 2008 or 2009, whenever these guys started. One of your biggest challenges would have been, okay, you got, let's say you convinced a bunch of drivers to sign up for Uber, and you did not get enough riders, then the drivers would just say, oh, I'm not making money, I'm going to go. Whereas on the other hand, if you said you had a bunch of riders and you didn't have enough drivers, the riders would say, oh, I just ordered a car, the car never showed up, I'm just going to take a cab, I'm going to take an auto, right? So it's super, super important to balance marketplaces, to have liquidity in a marketplace, because otherwise you'll just have a chicken and egg problem where, oh, I have a lot of drivers, oh, I don't have enough riders, you're never going to grow from there. So both these guys, Uber and Lyft, did very, very smart things in the very beginning. So one of the things they would do when they went into any city or town, and I'm sure a lot of the Indian players would have had very similar strategies as well. So whenever they went into a town, they would onboard a lot of drivers. They would offer guaranteed payouts to these drivers. So they would say, guys, sign up for Uber. We're going to guarantee you X amount of money per week. And in many markets, they still do this. Right? They have different forms of these incentives to make sure they have that liquidity. On the rider side, they would basically make the service free for a limited amount of time. They'd say, sign up for Uber, ride free for the first 1 week. And their bet was that users would be hooked after the first week. And they were, as you can see from the results thus far. Right? And again, they continue to do very similar things even today. Right now, if you look at one of your driver's apps, sometimes they get a notification that says, oh, there's a lot of demand in Adyar today. Adyar right now, go there. They get those notifications. At least they do in New York where I've seen these notifications. I'm sure there's some form of communication like that that tells drivers, go here, right? And once they started matching supply and demand, a virtuous cycle builds up. Because as drivers get more and more rides, drivers are happy, drivers keep coming back. As riders have quicker and quicker pickups, riders stay on the platform. And obviously, drivers invite other drivers, riders invite other riders, and that virtuous cycle builds up. All of that started to build up because in the very early days, they were laser focused on liquidity and on balancing their marketplaces. With that, we'll go to force number three. Social connection wins, right? And this, when you think about it, can be kind of obvious. And this is from my own experience. I did a little bit of work on Words with Friends. I did a lot more work on Crosswords with Friends. When we did, I remember our team doing this analysis where we said, let's look at user retention for all users who have at least one friend, and compare it with user retention who has zero friends. And if you don't know, user retention is the best measure of the health of a game, because if user retention is good, it just means users like the game enough to keep coming back, right? So what do you think happened when we compared retention for users who had at least one friend and users who had zero friends? Yeah? Yeah, retention rates were way higher for users with even one friend, right? And I kind of intuitively expected it, but I was most surprised by the magnitude of the difference. And when you think about it, it makes sense, right? Because nobody wants to play alone. Surprise, right? And nobody wants to do something alone, right? And I would imagine some of you are here because your friends are here. Social peer pressure can be enormously, enormously powerful. And if you think back to Facebook and Orkut, that's precisely what happened. I would bet that most of you joined Facebook because your friends were there. The more friends you had, the more often you wanted to check just to see what updates they had for you, right? And so building social connection can be enormously, enormously beneficial, not just for games, but also for, you know, in other spaces. So for instance, in fitness, right? So one of the people I interviewed on my podcast was Selena Tobacco-Waller, who's the CEO of an app called Gixo. That's a fitness app. One of the things she said was, one of the biggest differences in fitness is having that social component to it. If you put a workout on an app and you tell somebody, hey guys, do 10 push-ups in your home, it's not very likely that they're going to do it. But if you have them see other people on the app, if you have them have friends on the app who are also doing 10 push-ups, then that makes a huge difference. Even in offline fitness, people go so much more often to group classes rather than walk to the gym alone. So social connection can be very, very big for any product. So I would encourage you guys to ask yourselves, is there a social component I can put into what I'm building, right? Because if whatever you're building can be experienced with friends, it's so, so much more powerful. Yeah, and this is an example that I had of how apps and products can actually encourage social connection, right? This app basically says, invite one friend, get 250 free coins. Connect to Facebook, get 150 free coins. It can be as simple as this, right? You're basically telling the user what you want them to do. And you know that once a user invites a friend, they're going to stay longer, right? And every product decision can be made through this lens. Yeah. To move on to our next force, diversify your risk. Since I like pop quizzes, we've established that. What are the two images? Any guesses? Mm-hmm. Two images, two answers. Any guesses?
India.
Uh-huh.
India.
Okay, no, that's not India. Oh, although now that you point out, it does look like the southern tip of India. It's not India. Uh-huh.
New York City.
Uh-huh. Okay. That's a great guess, indeed. So that's New York City, and that's New York. That's a representation of New York in the 16th century. So one of the stories I'm so very fascinated by is the story of New York, partly because it's where I live, but also because basically went from being a wilderness to this metropolis in just over four centuries, right? The cities that were so much older, Paris, Amsterdam, London, they were so much older, and New York basically went from this to this in four centuries, whereas other cities took far, far, far longer to have such a transformation. And of course, I told the story of this on the podcast, and one of the elements that fascinated me so much was that New York actually had many, many phases of its growth, right? at some point, New York was a trading port in the very beginning. People would just bring stuff from Europe, take it back to the South. So there were no people who actually lived there. At another point, New York was... All right. At another point, New York was a manufacturing center. New York was making textiles, fabric, iron ore, salt, all that good stuff, right? And at a different point, New York eventually became the financial center of the world, right? So through all these phases, New York never really had an economic depression. Of course, it was hit when there was an economic downturn because finance was a big part, but New York never had a huge hit to it when manufacturing went down or port trading went down. So the guy I sat down with was Sam Roberts from the New York Times. I asked him, why did this happen? Why did New York never really decline like, let's say, Detroit? Right? Detroit's fortunes are down. Or Pittsburgh with steel, it's just down after steel went down. Why did that not happen to New York? Right? And what he said was very, very interesting. He said, New York always diversified its risk. New York was never fully dependent on one industry. So New York depended on tourism, tourism, services, financials, and a lot of industries. And this basically meant that even when there was something like the financial downturn, there were other industries that New York's economy could depend on, right? And that's very, very true even in your personal life. I mean, just the old saying, don't put your eggs in one basket. Or if you're investing money, you don't want to invest in just one category of stocks, right? So it's very, very helpful to think about diversifying your risk when you're building out something, right? And even if you look at something like Amazon, right? If all they were doing was selling books, it would be so much of a bigger risk than right now when they're basically selling everything, right? So I think this is a very helpful thing to keep in mind as you think about building technologies. So how do you diversify your risk? To go on, that was an emoji, and unfortunately, the emoji wasn't very projector friendly. Anyway, never mind. Now, so first number five is focus on the money, right? So one of the phases I'm very fascinated by was the first internet boom and bust in 1998. Right, and it was crazy from every story I've read. People pumped in money into every internet business. There was pets.com, there was like .com for everything, right? Somebody I had on my podcast, Selena Tobaccowala, one of her earlier gigs was with EY.com, and she tells me about how everybody you asked would say, oh, we have 10 million page views. We have 5 million eyeballs. Nobody was talking about money. Nobody was talking about financials because that was the internet boom, right? What EY did was actually pay attention to their financials, actually pay attention to their revenues. And they said, okay, we're growing, but we'll actually bring in money. We're going to go to the brands. We're going to go to Budweiser and have them sponsor a happy hour. We're going to go to some other brand, they're going to sponsor some of our other channels that we got on EY.com. That basically helped them evade the bust when there was basically bloodshed, right? And they actually turned out okay, and they ended up selling the company. And one of the reasons they survived that bloodshed was really because they focused on financial sustainability. It was because they focused on making sure that the product and the business was actually sustainable for the long term. And this is something that's very important, I think, especially when I meet a lot of engineers. I think there's a lot of focus on building a great product, which is very rightful, which is great. I think it's helpful to start thinking about how sound the financials of it and how sustainable this can be in the long term. To go on to our next force, test before you build, right? Some of the smartest people I know, they don't jump right into building a product. They don't jump right into building a technology. they test, they validate the product, and then they invest engineering time into actually building it. This example is from my friend Dominic Coriel, who's an amazing, amazing guy, very smart, super talented, right? He wanted to launch something called Surpriser, where they deliver surprise meals to you. Right? They look at your dietary preferences, they look at what you like, and then they give you surprise meals. You would think, that's an amazing idea. Or, oh, I don't know if that's going to work. How do you find out? Right? You could build this, you could build a website, you could build a recommendation engine, put it out and say, all right, let's see how this performs. But that's going to take a lot of time, a lot of engineering, a lot of money. Right? What this guy did, what Dominic did was, he set up this one page, he hired a designer, this took maybe 30 to 60 minutes to make, he set up this page that said, foodies rejoice, Surpriser discovers great meals, tell us what you love to eat, enter the zip code to start. He sent users from Facebook ads to this page, right? When they entered the zip code, they saw that page, which again took 30 minutes to build. It said, what a surprise, we don't service your area yet. And he showed that to everybody, basically. Right? Basically, everybody who saw the Facebook ad, put in their zip code, said, got to see, oh, we don't service your area yet, but enter your name and we'll give you points as soon as we launch. So, how did this help? How did this happen? Anybody in the audience? Mm-hmm. Any guess? How is this better than actually building out a website, building a recommendation engine, and launching? Exactly, right? That's a great answer. So by doing this, he spent 60 minutes of design time, $50 on Facebook ads, to understand if people wanted this product or not, right? And he said, oh, people entered their zip code, people entered their email, 10% actually shared, so people actually want this product. That's when he started building the website. Yeah?
So is it 25% of 30%?
25% of 30%. Yeah, 25% of 30%. Yeah, right? And I think this is a very important lesson, again, because it's very easy to want to build. It's very easy to want to make new technology without quite understanding if the technology is actually going to be viable, right? And one of my favorite thinkers, Peter Drucker, who I was mentioning earlier today, nothing so useless as doing efficiently that which should not be done at all, right? I mean, if something's totally useless, you do it really, really efficiently. What's the point? What's the point? Right? So the smartest people test before they build. Yes, you hear stories that Steve Jobs is a visionary. Apple builds products like this. You'll be surprised to hear that Apple also does customer research. They probably don't do this exact thing, but before they launch any iPhone, any product, they do a ton of focus groups. They do a ton of research. My friends have gotten these emails saying, Apple invites you to test out XYZ product. So trust me, if Apple's public relations team wants you to believe that they do no testing, it's not necessarily the whole unvarnished truth. The smartest people test before they build, and I think that's something that can de-risk your ventures, that can mitigate your risk as you're building out something new. The next lesson is from Duolingo. This is from my friend Gina Gottlieb. And her lesson was to simplify, basically, right? And she was on my podcast. And one of the things she says is about how they were thinking about launching in different countries. And they were like, should we have completely customized different user interfaces in every country of the world, right? It's very tempting. Right, and as engineers, it's tempting to be perfect, to make things right. And then she was like, you know, that's just going to take so much work. And everybody in every part of the world is actually more similar than dissimilar. So we're actually going to go with a very similar format across the world. We we're going to have very similar user interfaces in most parts of the world, right? And we launched with that, and that allowed them to scale much, much faster than they would have if they had chosen to customize their app for every single country of the world. So when possible, simplify. The next and the last force I have for you guys is to adapt, because it's very easy to think that formulas can solve your problem, right? It's very easy to think that you have a checklist of these eight forces, keep this checklist and you have a $1 billion company. I don't have a $1 billion company either, right? I can tell you what I find, but you still have to adapt what you find to what works for you. And one of my favorite examples is from Linebike. So my friend Dandria's advised Linebike, and he tells me about this one time, he tells me about this one time when Linebike was like, oh, they were looking at the retention profiles of the users, and then they realized that users in certain parts of the city had retention that wasn't so great, and they looked at their analytics and they were trying to figure out what was going on, and then they realized the parts where the retention is super low are parts with uphill routes, right? And no amount of analytics would have told you that. The only way to find out would be to actually go out into the city and find out, right? And to these guys' credit, they did, and they found out and they figured that out, right? So I think what I would encourage you guys to do is that all of these forces, all of these, everything I'm telling you is perhaps a starting point, but you eventually have to find your own path because your mileage may vary. What works for me may not work for you. What works for Facebook may not work for you guys. So think for yourself, figure out what works for you guys. Because like I said, you guys are going to build the next wave of technologies. You guys, many of you, and even if you aren't starting your own business, you're going to be working on some kind of technology. Even if you're not working on some kind of technology, you're going to have to make a choice about where you're going to work, right? Even if it's on the business side. You might have a chance to work at the next Orkut or the next Facebook. How are you going to make those decisions? It helps to have some sense of understanding what technologies will eventually get adopted, what technologies will eventually see mass adoption. To recap, these were all the eight forces that I talked about. And this was the key takeaway. Like I said, ask yourselves not just why things work, which is a great starting point. As engineers, as thinkers, we ask ourselves all the time, why things work, what can we do next, what's next, what's exciting, what's amazing. I think just as important a question is how things will grow. What happens after this? What happens after you build it, right? Because it's an easy trope to say, build it and they will come. I think it's important to ask what happens after you build it. So thank you. That's all from me. If you'd like, feel free to connect on LinkedIn. I host office hours. Basically, you come talk to me, ask me whatever questions you want. Feel free to hit me up. You can email me, shamant@gmail.com. As always, very grateful to be here, very excited to be here. Thank you all for having me.
Hey guys, this is Shamant again. Before you go, I have a very important favor to ask of you. If you get any pleasure or inspiration from this episode, could you please leave a review on your favorite podcasting platform, be it iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcast fix? Each episode of this podcast takes many, many days of my time and is very much a labor of love. Whenever you write a review, it will not only be a great deal of encouragement to me, but it will also help support getting the word out about How Things Grow. Thank you so much for listening to How Things Grow. I will look forward to seeing you with the next episode.